Welcome back to part two of our episode on David Bowie related musicals. How you doing?
I'm doing fine. So let's dive in and talk about the other David Bowie musical, Labyrinth.
Also from 1986. So yes, Jennifer Connelly is Sarah Williams. She's a teenager with a big imagination and a love for fantasy stories. Her favorite is a book called The Labyrinth, which she spends her time memorizing and acting out. Sarah gets stuck watching her fussy baby stepbrother, Toby, when she learns that her stepmother gave Toby one of her favorite teddy bears, a tattered little bear called Lancelot. Sarah shouts into the air for somebody to just take her away from this awful place. And in order to get Toby to stop crying, she tells him the story of how the Goblin King was in love with the girl who was forced to stay at home with the baby and that he had given her certain powers. But while Sarah loves the story of the labyrinth, she in no way believes the story could be real. She is realistic about these things. However, when Toby won't stop crying, out of frustration, Sarah calls for the goblins to take her brother. The crying immediately stops, and when she looks around for him, she learns that her wish was in fact granted. Jareth, played by David Bowie, the king of the goblins, he appears and he gives her an option. She could take her dreams in the form of an orb, or she can spend 13 hours in his kingdom, which is an ever-changing maze called the Labyrinth. Now, if she can get to the castle at the center in time, her brother will be spared from becoming a goblin. Sarah is resolved to save her brother, and the king leaves her to do her task. She immediately meets a dwarf with a feisty attitude who shows her how to enter the labyrinth. His name is Hoggle. He's voiced by Brian Henson, and he tells her not to take anything for granted in that place. After a series of unusual turns and encounters, she finds herself stuck in an oubliette, and Hoggle is sent by the Goblin King to, quote-unquote, rescue her. But Hoggle is beginning to like Sarah, and with the help of a bribe from her, he chooses to help her get to the center and reach her brother, rather than take her back to the start of the labyrinth per Jareth's orders. It turns out that Jareth knows about Hoggle's disobedience, and he shows up to confront them. Sarah displays a bit of overconfidence, and as a result, Jareth takes away 3 hours of her time. Hoggle declares himself a friend to no one and abandons her. Forcing herself not to be afraid, Sarah finds Ludo, a giant furry beast and a gentle creature despite his massive size, who becomes her friend when she saves him from being tortured by a bunch of goblins. But she becomes separated from Ludo and finds herself in a forest where she meets the Fire Gang. These are creatures that are able to dismember themselves. They try to take off her head, which of course doesn't work, but it doesn't stop them from trying to mutilate her, so she finally grabs their heads and throws them away. Hoggle comes to her rescue again, but she doesn't know that the Goblin King had threatened that if she ever kissed him, he would immediately be sent to the Bog of Eternal Stench. And as soon as her lips touch his head in a kiss of gratitude for being rescued, the floor beneath them collapses and they fall into the bog. Thankfully, they didn't fall into the bog itself, which would result in their smelling bad forever. They find Ludo there and they meet with Sir Didymus, a fox knight with a sheepdog as his steed. He gets into a fight with Ludo, who bests him. Sir Didymus decides to help them in her quest for her brother. As Sarah begins to cross the bridge, it collapses, and Sarah grabs onto an overhead branch to keep from falling in. Ludo summons rocks to rise from the bog, and that gives them a path across. Now they're close to the castle, but unbeknownst to Sarah, the Goblin King has forced something on Hoggle. He was to give Sarah a peach that would make her forget about Toby, and since they've been traveling for hours, Sarah begins to get hungry. Hoggle gives her the peach, and she bites into it. Out of shame, Hoggle runs away. Ludo and Sir Didymus continue on, unaware that Sarah has stopped walking with them. By eating the peach, Sarah has found herself in a dream. She's in a ballroom full of masked faces. She's wearing a beautiful silver gown, and she begins to dance with the Goblin King. After a while, she remembers that she has some kind of task to perform, and she breaks away from Jareth. She grabs a chair, and she shatters the wall, and therefore the crystal ball in which she was trapped. Sarah awakens in a junkyard with the peach still in her hand, but she still can't quite remember what she was supposed to be doing. A goblin woman with a collection of knickknacks on her back leads her to a room. It appears to be her own bedroom. Sarah runs to her bed and she flops down onto it, burying her face in the pillow. It had all just been a terrible, terrible dream. But in fact, it wasn't a dream, for as soon as she opens the bedroom door, the goblin woman comes in and tries collecting a bunch of items from the room for Sarah to tote around for herself. One of the items is Sarah's copy of The Labyrinth, and she is immediately reminded that she needs to save Toby. As soon as she remembers, the room collapses, revealing the junkyard again. Her friends had followed her out to the junkyard when she had been trapped in the crystal, and they pulled her out of the rubble. They quickly hurry to the nearby castle with less than an hour remaining. They enter the Goblin City, which surrounds the castle, and soon find themselves set upon by goblins attacking them in hordes. Once again, it's up to Ludo to summon the rocks, which clears the goblins out and opens the path to the castle. When our heroes reach the throne room, it's empty. A clock on the wall shows us that Sarah has less than 5 minutes remaining to reach her brother. There appears to be only one way that Jareth could have gone with the baby, and Sarah insists on going alone to face him. The room at the top is a nightmare out of an Escher drawing, with perspectives unclear and no real sense of up or down. Jareth throws a crystal ball which bounces in multiple directions, and it lands in Toby's hands. Now that she knows where Toby is, all she has to do is get to him, but that's kind of the problem. With the multiple perspectives, she's having trouble getting to him, and he's in motion. Finally, she takes a literal leap of faith to get to him, and when she lands, she finds herself facing the Goblin King slowly walking toward her from out of the shadows. She begins to recite the lines her story said would defeat him and finalize her brother's safety, but the king stops her, and he offers her dreams to her once again. He even offers himself as her slave, but her only resolve at this point is to save Toby, so she completes her dialogue and finds herself back in her home. The defeated Goblin King flies out the window, banished to live in the form of an owl. Sarah runs upstairs to ensure that her brother has been returned, and she finds him sleeping perfectly peacefully. She goes to her own room, and she begins to put away the things that were part of her childhood fantasies, but as she does so, she sees the faces of her friends from the labyrinth staring at her in the mirror. They tell her they would always be around if she needed them, and she told them that every now and then in her life, she would. She turns away from the mirror to see a bunch of the characters actually in the room and begins celebrating with them. And as we move away from her house, the white owl outside flies away.
Okay, so as I mentioned at the beginning, this was directed by Jim Henson. And sadly, this was the last project that he directed before his death. Now, people of my generation and younger, and maybe of Claude's generation as well, know him for what Henson contributed to children's television. Most notably, of course, Sesame Street, which was produced by the Educational Workshop. And Henson, of course, contributed to all of the Muppet characters that appeared on the show, like Big Bird, Oscar the Grouch, and Bert and Ernie, among many others. And he had worked with Muppets before that in commercials and on a string of variety shows. And then after Sesame Street had started in the mid to late 70s, he did The Muppet Show, which was a variety show that brought together a couple of the Muppets from Sesame Street. Well, actually one, Kermit the Frog, and then a host of others, including, of course, Miss Piggy, even though she was voiced by Henson, one of Henson's fellow Muppeteers, Frank Oz, and also Fozzie Bear and the Swedish Chef and a host of others. But although Henson was happy to leave his mark on Sesame Street and with both the Muppet Show and the three Muppet movies that he was involved with, he always felt pigeonholed as a children's entertainer and felt that he was capable of more. And the movie that he did before this, The Dark Crystal, which is another fantasy film, although that one is with all Muppets, That and Labyrinth were sort of pushes into more adult territory and also more character-based material rather than the story-dominated material of the first three Muppet movies, which also provide the template for most of the other Muppet movies that were made after that.
Yeah, I think though it's worth mentioning, though, that I think Henson was kind of like wanting to do this all along, because you kind of overlook this, and is one of the other projects that Henson's Muppets were involved in was the first season of Saturday Night Live. There were about 15 right. sketches during that season that was called The Land of Gorch. And it was Muppets that were specifically created for the show. And these were like kind of monster type, or somewhere between monsters and dinosaurs type creatures. And they had a hard time writing for these Muppets. So they finally abandoned the idea of the sketch altogether. So you had the Muppets in the first season. There were references to them in the second season. They were just kind of joked about, as far as like a running joke for second season, and then never really heard from again. So I think right. he was always looking to get into like more adult fare with the Muppets.
Right. And he had done adults. He had attempted some adult oriented shorts in the 70s as well. But mm-hmm. I think part of the problem is that even though he did want to do more adult stuff, I think he felt what Saturday Night Live was doing was much different than his idea of adult oriented material as well. Mm-hmm. But anyway, another thing that it was feeding into this movie, although, as I mentioned when we talked about Under Fire and Return of the Secaucus 7, that the 80s as a movie decade were a lot more complicated than I think most people give them credit for. You did see a lot of big budget blockbuster movies that were hoping to capitalize on the wake of the Star Wars movies and Spielberg's movies. And what that included was a wave of fantasy movies that were made during the 80s. And I'm thinking of movies like Clash of the Titans, Dragon Slayer, Flash Gordon, Krull, Lady Hawk, Legend, Time Bandits, Neverending Story, and Willow. Most of those, and movie we mentioned in the first part, Highlander, as mm-hmm. well, even though that's more of a modern day fantasy, for part of it anyway. But most of these movies, except for Time Bandits and maybe a couple others, were not big box office hits. And most of them at best met with indifferent or mixed reviews, but a lot of them have become cult favorites over the years, and so has Labyrinth. And yeah. there's a couple things that distinguish Labyrinth from these other fantasy movies. The first one, of course, is that it is the only one of them to have a woman at the center of the movie, or a young teenage girl, as it happens in this movie. Now, it is true there are strong women characters, or there are women characters with major parts in Flash Gordon. I don't think the actress playing Dale Arden, quite frankly, made her into a strong character.
Not so much,
that's another discussion entirely. And there are major female parts in Lady Hawk, Legend, The Neverending Story, and Willow. But again, Labyrinth is the only one to have a female character at the center of it all. The other thing that distinguished this movie is that it is one of the only movies made during this cycle where the character knows that the main character knows that they're in a fantasy movie. I think the only one that sort of comes close to that is Time Bandits. The main character, Neverending Story, doesn't realize that they're in a fairy story until the very end. But in Labyrinth, they are fully aware throughout the entire story, and it's just that they have to remember the rules as they're going through. And in the 90s, with the Scream movies and other movies doing this for horror, the concept of a character knowing that they're involved in a genre story was often done as a way to present the material in a tongue-in-cheek manner, the winking to the audience not to take this too seriously. And even though there is a lot of humor in this movie, there's no winking at the audience here. All that is played very straight so that the stakes are high in the fact, you know, we believe the stakes of Sarah wanting to get back her baby brother, even as she may have she may have wailed against taking care of him and the crying and all that. She wants to save her brother, who, by the way, Toby Frood, I don't know if that's how you pronounce it, but he was the son of the person who helped Henson with the concept of this movie, Brian Froud. He was cast, I guess, for convenience sake. But anyway, as I said, there's no winking at the audience. Everything is played straight. And I think that's along with the fact that this is a movie with a female character at the center is one of the movie's strengths.
Yeah, I think you're right in that respect. And I think really anything involving Muppets, and I'm going to point to Muppet Christmas Carol as a really good example of this, is basically is more successful when you take the Muppets at face value. Well, not you. It's actually when the human characters within the film take the Muppets at face value, okay? And so the Muppets can Muppet all they like, and there are going to be occasional, like, you know, winks at the audience or jokes specifically for the adults when it's a kid movie or, you know, that kind of thing. But the fact is, when you see Jennifer Connelly or Michael Caine, okay, interacting with those Muppets, you know, Caine is like, he is doing like the Royal Shakespeare performance of Ebenezer Scrooge. And Jennifer Connelly is doing the same thing. She's like, you know, she doesn't come upon, you know, Hoggle and say, what the hell is that? You know, she just like, oh, there's a guy there and this is what he looks like. And so she takes everything the way it's meant to be taken. So yeah, we're not doing the jokey kind of thing, even though some of these characters, and Hoggle would definitely be one of them, have funny things to say.
Well, yeah, but it's not just that. Obviously, yes, in every Muppet movie, all the actors are directed to treat the Muppets like other characters. Michael Caine is a good example because even though I don't love Muppets Christmas Carol as much as I love the Muppet movie, unlike the Muppet movie and the Great Muppet Caper and the Muppets Take Manhattan, he's playing a human role that lasts from beginning to end, whereas in the other ones, the humans appear pretty much as cameos or supporting characters,
Okay. Whereas
he's the main character. But I'm talking more in the sense of, you know, even though Sarah recognizes there are rules to be followed in a fantasy story. It's not done in the same way as, say, in the Scream movies when Jamie Kennedy is listing the rules to survive in a horror movie. It's not done in that same type of tone. It's played in a more straightforward manner.
Sure, I get that, and that's the thing that, like, you know, the Scream films, I think, are just a lot more meta in that respect, as opposed to, yeah, you know, Jennifer Connelly's character Sarah is she recognizes that there are rules, she has to remember them, she has to play by them, and, you know, she doesn't have to basically enumerate them for the sake of pretty much anything.
Right. Now, getting back to the Muppets, there's only one scene in the movie where the Muppet with the Sarah is in, where there's no Muppets at all. And that's the ball sequence when she's sort of under the spell of what the old woman gave her. And she's dancing with Jareth. And we see other human people dancing around wearing masks as well. You know, you get used to the Muppet characters that are shown throughout the movie. And so when you get that sequence, obviously it's while Sarah is not quite herself, which is why it doesn't come off as jarring as it might be, where you have this one sequence that's without humans, that's with only humans in it, other than, of course,
the opening.
The non-fantasy part, right. The opening of the movie, yes. Now, there are a lot of familiar elements thrown together into this movie, which is another way of the movie showing characters who are aware, or running parallel to the fact that you have characters who are aware that they're in a fantasy story. When that old lady character is giving Sarah the food to eat, which will make her go under, you know, that's straight out of Snow White and the Seven Dwarves. And the journey that Sarah has to go on to is reminiscent of The Wizard of Oz. And that's one of the books that's in Sarah's room, the L. Frank Baum's The Wonderful Wizard of Oz. And of course, like any movie where someone goes from the real world to a strange world, you got a lot of Alice in Wonderland here. There's even a sequence where Sarah falls down a hole with the helping hands, that's very reminiscent of Alice falling down the hall, and actually also very reminiscent of a Muppet Show episode where Brooke Shields played Alice in an adaptation of Alice in Wonderland. And also, Henson admitted that he stole a lot from Maurice Sendak, particularly his book, Where the Wild Things Are. So you've got all these elements here together, and yet, for me anyway, they make up a cohesive whole.
Yeah, they do. And it, you know, it's funny that you mentioned that, because it's like, now that I think about it, yeah, there is like that whole wild things going on there. That makes a ton of sense to me, actually.
Right. Now, it is amazing in a sense that this does hold up as well as it does, because you had a lot of people involved in writing this. Now, the main credited writer on the movie is Terry Jones, the late, great former member of Monty Python, who brought a lot of the cheeky humor to the role. And he's the only credited screenwriter on here, but there was a guy named Dennis Lee who was heavily involved in writing the script. And Henson, when he wanted to make Sarah's role and the emotional journey more meaningful, called on Laura Phillips, who was one of his collaborators on another show that he did for kids, Fraggle Rock. And then also Elaine May apparently did some uncredited work on the script. Hmm. And they did bring Jones back to restore a lot of the humor that takes place here. I'm sure he was heavily involved in the scene, for example, where they try to get past Didymus, who keeps insisting, "No one may pass without my permission."
Yeah.
And then finally it hits Sarah, "Well, may we have your permission?" "Oh! Okay, sure."
Sure, why not?
So, yeah, that's a very Python-esque little bit there. And then also, I'm sure when Didymus is surrounded by all the many creatures that the Goblin King has thrown against them, he said, "Ha! I can take you all." That are words to that effect. That's a very Python-esque moment as well. Now, over the years, there's been a certain strain of fandom for this movie, which insists that the only way that this movie can be enjoyed is for camp value. And part of it is justified by talking about Bowie's costume here, which does, which is the pants are similar to the, are seen as being similar to the bat nipples worn by George Clooney in the 97 Batman and Robin movie. But I think that's a real disservice to the movie. Now, camp in general terms means that it's something that you enjoy in an ironic way, that it's not meant to be taken seriously. But personally speaking, I think you can enjoy this movie if you take it in a serious way. And I also wonder how much of that idea that it can only be enjoyed as a camp movie has to do with the fact that you have a woman character at the center of the movie, and that, you know, somebody sometime decided that no movies with a woman character at the center like this can be enjoyed seriously. It has to be done in an ironic or camp fashion. And that bothers the hell out of me. So I don't think of this as a camp movie at all.
And I agree with you in that. I think, you know, for camp to be like decent camp, you kind of have to know you're being campy. And that wasn't necessarily the intent here. I don't think it's necessarily what comes off. And I don't really feel that you can I don't know. I just have a hard time with the idea of like assigning camp value to something that doesn't necessarily have it. I mean, if you want to, you know, watch it ironically because you think it's a little bit dumb, okay, that's on you. But that doesn't make the film itself camp. I'm not really buying that argument at all.
Yeah. Now, let's talk about the performances here. Jennifer Connelly, although drew a lot of criticism for her performance at the time, or drew some criticism, this wasn't her first rodeo. She had appeared in a Dario Argento horror movie called Phenomena before this. And she's also quite good playing the younger version of Elizabeth McGovern's character in Sergio Leone's Once Upon a Time in America, as it was intended to be. Apparently, in the cut version that was originally released to U.S. theaters in 1984, her part was pretty much reduced to nothing. Only in the extended version that came out later was she a part of the movie. And it's a really good performance there. But I think she's really good here too, handling the coming of age parts well, you know, being convincing as the bratty put upon teenage girl at the end who has to grow up and learn to confront her fears and her desires and all of what's in her that she might not like, but also, of course, the evil, although not too evil because this is a fantasy movie, Jareth as well. And, you know, as you mentioned, you know, she does take the Muppets seriously as characters, Hoggle or Ludo or Didymus or whoever. I think she handles that all well.
Yeah, she does a pretty good job. I think there was one part where it was just like her line reading felt a little bit weird for me. And I'm trying to search in my memory. I think it was like early upon in her first encounter with Hoggle. There was something she said and I was like, I don't think she really did that one right. But for the most part, I think she did a pretty good job. And as you say, as we both said, you know, she's taking her situation seriously. She's taking your character seriously. And what's more, the fact that she is able to transform herself from this, you know, whiny teenager that you kind of hate as into somebody that you wind up rooting for in the end and maybe even like a little bit. Yeah, sure. Why not?
All right. Now, as far as Bowie goes, Jareth apparently was somewhat inspired by a couple of brooding figures from literature, Heathcliff from Wuthering Heights and Rochester from Jane Eyre. But he has his own sort of, for lack of a better term, je ne sais quoi about him as well. And Bowie does a good job bringing that out. He also performs the songs that he wrote for the movie well, which include Underground, which plays over the opening and closing credits. And then also a song that whenever I put this movie on at any video store that I was working at, I would always sing along and dance to, Magic Dance. And then there's a couple other songs that he sings as well that he wrote for the movie. And unlike Absolute Beginners, where, oh, As the World Falls Down and Within You, and he also wrote the song that those Muppets with the heads that come off performed that are torturing Ludo, Chili Down. He wrote that song for the movie. And unlike Absolute Beginners, which, as I said, he had mixed feelings about, Bowie had fond memories of this movie, both making it, and he thought it was a good movie and a good performance. And I would agree. I think he does an excellent job. And he even handles what could have been potentially icky, the fact that there are sexual overtones between Jared and Sarah throughout part of the movie, especially in the ball sequence and in the end. You know, he handles that without going too far, and Henson wisely doesn't go too far in that as well. So, yeah, I think he does a good job.
Yeah, I mean, he is supposed to be, after all, you know, a villain here and kind of evil and that kind of thing. But he's also, when we talk about a character like this, and so I don't want you to read this the wrong way. I don't want anybody to read this the wrong way. Is that he is, in a sense, seducing her, but not in the sexual sense. And so he is going to appeal to the fact that she is a teenage girl, that she does have this active fantasy life. And so, yeah, there is going to be a little bit of seduction, like in that dance scene, but it's never a sexual kind of thing. It's just like you can be a part of this world. And that's a hard line, I think, to walk along without quite crossing over from one side to the other. And he does it. He's a good villain, and he's not a mustache twirler kind of guy. Although he is clearly he's kind of capricious in some of his villainy, because he's like changing the rules on her and that kind of thing. And so, you think you can do this in 13 hours? Cool. Do it in 10 instead. Like that kind of thing. So, you know, he's a bad guy. And at the same time, he's a guy you can almost admire a little bit, just because he is kind of smooth and oily, just like Partners was, you know, in the previous film.
Right. Now, a couple pieces of trivia I want to mention. As most fans of the song Magic Dance and of this movie goes, the song opens with Bowie saying to the other goblins around, "You remind me of the babe." This is actually taken from a 1940s movie called The Bachelor and the Bobby Soxer, starring Cary Grant, Myrna Loy, and Shirley Temple. Cary Grant says something like this in that movie, except that "you remind me of the man" and not "you remind me of the babe." Mm-hmm. Another bit of trivia is that the owl that Jareth shapeshifts into, according to IMDb, was the first fully computer-generated animal to appear on movie screens and be effective. And yeah, I think it's an effective-looking owl. I was kind of surprised when I first read about that it was completely CGI, because it does look very convincing, even nearly over 35 years later.
Yeah, I mean, and compare it to, say, like the computer-generated animation going on in Tron, which was only a couple of years earlier, where everything has a very hard-edged look to it. So that they were able to carry off that foul as well as they did. That's fantastic.
Okay. And the last bit of trivia I want to mention is that, although I have not read it, there was a manga sequel to Labyrinth called Return to Labyrinth. I don't know if it was turned into an animated series as well, but it went from 2006 to 2010. So it might be worth checking out. It might not. I can't say for sure. So, Claude, do you have anything you want to add before we wrap this up?
I have three small things. One is, in those early sequences, like most of this film was shot in England, but for some reason, the scenes that were shot in Sarah's neighborhood were shot in upstate New York, which was kind of interesting. Most of it in a town called Haverstraw, but there were a couple of others, like in the Nyack area. And it was one of those things, like, I just recognized instantly. I was like, that's New York. I know it's New York. And I went and I looked. Sure enough, I was right. That was just kind of interesting that they chose that for that neighborhood. They could have picked anywhere. The second thing is we forgot to mention that Jareth has this thing that he does with some crystal balls where he's kind of like twisting them in his hand one-handedly. And that's not David Bowie. We should mention there is actually a juggler who is doing that. And basically what he's doing is he's like kind of squatting down behind David Bowie and sticking his hand through the outfit and doing the thing with the ball, so that Bowie has to kind of hide that arm. And so it was a very cool practical effect, and it looked really, really good. And third, you brought up all of these films during the 80s that had like that fantasy component to it with the Flash Gordon and the Highlander and da 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 da. And I have to think that with so many Muppets in this film, this is probably the film of that collection that has more left-handed characters in it than any other, because most Muppets are left-handed.
Okay, I have to admit that that's probably something that my brother, who is left-handed, would have paid attention more to than I would. But there are two names involved in the movie that I did forget to mention that I should bring up before I wrap this up. First of all, along with Bowie writing the songs that we hear performed in the movie, the instrumental music was composed by Trevor Jones, who has gone on to do other film scores, but who you might best know as one of the members of the Buggles, the band responsible for Video Killed the Radio Star, the very first video to be played on MTV. And there's one other major name connected to this movie, and that was one of the executive producers on the movie, George Lucas. Now, there is a lot of things that you can say about Lucas, both good and bad, but I will admit, from all accounts, Lucas did not meddle with Henson on this movie at all. He basically let him do his own thing. You know, he lent money and support when necessary, but other than that, he didn't do anything to interfere with what Henson was trying to do. And that is a good thing that, you know, I will rank on his side, along with the fact that he used his money and his clout to help Akira Kurosawa make Kagemusha when he was having trouble getting it made, and with the fact that he gave all the people involved with American Graffiti and The New Hope points, even though it was they weren't in their original contracts. Mm-hmm. Once the movies became successes, he actually gave his money, his profits, to them. So rank that another part of the good column when it comes to George Lucas.
Okay, and maybe that explains also the owl, because that means that Industrial Light and Magic was probably involved with the production then.
Most likely, yes. So this is the part where we tell you that both Absolute Beginners and Labyrinth are available on DVD. And pretty cheaply, which is a good thing for Absolute Beginners, because unfortunately that movie is not available for streaming at all. But as I said, you can go to Amazon or eBay or somewhere like that, maybe a used store or a thrift store somewhere, and get it cheaply. As far as Labyrinth goes for streaming, it is currently available to stream on Netflix, and you can also rent or buy it through Amazon, Apple TV, Google Play, and most of the other usual suspects for streaming services.
It's also worth just checking your public library to see if they have a DVD copy as well.
Well, okay, I hesitate about that because my local library is not getting as many DVDs as it used to. But by all means, if it's there, please do rent it, because libraries do need your support.
And what the heck? You already bought it that way.
Yes. So coming up in our next episode, we're going to be looking at movies based on concept albums. At least the movies that I think are good versions of concept albums, which are from 1979, Quadrophenia, based on the Who album of the same name, the movie directed by Frank Rodham, and from 1982, Pink Floyd, The Wall, based on the album Pink Floyd's The Wall, and the movie directed by Alan Parker. And Quadrophenia and Pink Floyd The Wall, again, are both available on DVD. And check your local library for those as well. Quadrophenia is available in the 2-disc Criterion Edition, which is the one that I own. But that's also available to stream if you subscribe to HBO Max or the Criterion Channel or Fubo. You can also watch it with ads on Crackle, and then also for free on the channel Plex, or you can rent or buy it through Amazon or Apple TV only, whereas Pink Floyd The Wall, unfortunately, is not available for streaming. And given the fact that the only surviving members surrounding the film don't seem eager to have anything to do with the movie anymore, probably won't be coming to streaming anytime soon, so you'll have to track it down on DVD, but believe me when I tell you it's worth it. Mm-hmm. Now, as far as we go here, in addition to our website, wordsandmovies.com, we also have a Facebook page, Words and Movies, and you can also email us. In addition to commenting on the Facebook page, you can also email us with a question or comment. Our email address is wordsandmoviespod@gmail.com. And myself, Sean Gallagher, I am also on Facebook under my name. And I also am still lurking on Instagram. if you want me to follow you, just send a request. And depending on what I see, I may follow you back. And how about you, Claude?
Well, I might as well confess that, yes, I can also be found on the Book of Face under my name. But you can also check out my other podcast, How Good It Is, at howgooditis.com. And that show, in fact, does also have an Instagram presence.
Okay, so thank you very much for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.
Thank you so much. Rebecca, please take us away.
This is your announcer, Rebecca Blackman, with the closing credits. This show was produced by Sean Gallagher and Claude Call, with editing and post-production by Claude, with some help from Mophonic. Audio clips are used under fair use rules for commentary and educational framing. Everything else is copyrighted by Claude Call and Sean Gallagher. The theme music you're bopping along to right now is by Solar Flare and is used under a Creative Commons license. Podcast hosting is provided by Anchor.fm. If you want to support the show, go to anchor.fm/wordsandmovies and click on the support link. Who knows? Maybe they'll even kick a few bucks my way. Thanks for listening.